They want to use this as an issue in November to scare people, and they don't want to talk about their own radical record. Instead, they want to falsely claim somebody is coming to take contraception.
That was Senator Ted Cruz arguing on the floor in June before Republicans voted to block a bill designed to protect access to contraception. Here's New Hampshire Senator Gene Shaheen, a Democrat.
The former president, Donald Trump, implied that states should be allowed to decide access to contraception, potentially setting a dangerous precedent that would harm millions of women and families who rely on contraception.
While contraception may still be accessible, is it free? The Affordable Care Act requires private insurance plans to cover a broad range of contraceptive services for women. But in a letter to the U.S. Government Accountability Office, Senator Bernie Sanders said some insurance companies are charging Americans for birth control. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Why is that happening? And could a lawsuit change what insurance plans are required to cover? Joining me now to talk about that are Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Dean and Professor of Law, Judith Darr. Welcome back, Dean Darr.
Great to be with you, Lucy.
Great to have you. And Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio physician, Dr. Meredith Pensack. Thanks for being here, Dr. Pensack.
Thank you.
Dr. Pensack, the Affordable Care Act has required insurance plans for many years now to provide contraceptive services for free. What was the argument for that?
Well, I think there's a lot of arguments for that, but I think that some of the highlights are that we know that the majority of adults in the United States use some form of contraception, and this has been that way for many, many years now. It's not a new thing. And we also know that Americans overwhelmingly support the use of contraception and want to be able to use it. They want to be able to use it to help plan their family better. Many women use contraception and birth control for other issues like heavy or painful periods, endometriosis. So having access to contraception is something that is vital and important for the American people. And so I think we saw that reflected finally in the passage of the ACA, when we finally had that coverage for something that people had been using anyways for a very long time and continue to use and support.
And Dr. Pensack, do you have any feel for how much women were spending on contraception before this requirement? I guess I'm wondering if spending on birth control generally made healthcare a lot more expensive for women than for men before this ACA requirement.
Yeah, it definitely made healthcare more expensive for women than for men. I don't have exact numbers in front of me, but I do know that many women spent a significant amount of income, and not just women, right? Families. This is for a lot of people a family decision to be using contraception, of hard-earned wages on medication that's really preventative and necessary. And so that for a lot of people, it was sometimes completely inaccessible because of the cost. We know that a lot of patients or a lot of people don't make enough money to buy the medications that they need that aren't fully covered by insurance or might not be covered at all. And contraception was definitely one of those.
Dean Darr, almost since this requirement became law, there have been legal challenges, there have been people and companies who have filed lawsuits arguing that providing contraceptive care violates their religious beliefs. How have those lawsuits shaped coverage by insurance companies?
You're right, Lucy. From the beginning, there was contention over the provision of birth control in the ACA, and lawsuits have unfolded. In 2014, which was just 2 years after the ACA became effective in 2012, there was a case famously known as Hobby Lobby, where the Supreme Court upheld the opportunity for certain employers to refuse to provide coverage based on religious objection. And the legal landscape has unfolded currently there are opportunities for employers based on either moral conviction or religious objection to refuse to provide services. So structurally, the ACA has been less than adequate in terms of providing full coverage. And then also, we can talk later about this, the enforcement mechanisms under the law are, I think, unclear at best and weak perhaps. And for that reason, you have this notion now that about 25% of women who access contraception have to pay for it, even though the ACA was designed to be a cost no-share policy for American women.
And Dean Darr, you mentioned this legal approach citing religious objection. Is that becoming more common in cases like this? And are courts becoming more receptive to that argument?
Well, the Supreme Court has certainly been receptive to that argument in the Hobby Lobby case and then some follow-up cases ever since. And the Trump administration in 2017 issued a ruling that essentially codified the Supreme Court's holding that the religious belief and moral conviction could be effective for employers in general, not just the limited type of employers that brought suit to the court. So we have this large hole in the ACA that can be availed rather broadly, and for that reason, you have this structural barrier to access.
We're talking about why some women are paying for birth control that's supposed to be free under federal law and a lawsuit that could change what insurance plans are required to cover. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. In June, Senator Bernie Sanders wrote this letter to the U.S. Government Accountability Office saying that insurers across the country aren't complying with that ACA mandate. Senator Sanders is asking the GAO to investigate. Dean Darr, what could the outcome of a GAO investigation be? What kind of impact could that have?
I think that they'll just confirm what other studies that have been published have revealed, which is this large percentage of women who are having to pay, even though the ACA is guaranteeing a cost-free approach. But if it's pursued at this more general level, then perhaps we can start looking at the enforcement side. If you take a look at the federal guidance to women who have been denied cost-free coverage, it's, in my mind, very complicated. It directs them to contact the Department of Labor, the Department of Health and Human Services. These are very high bars for women who are just trying to get reproductive health care. So I think that the report at the end of the day might focus not on access, because the bill itself does provide that, but rather on enforcing and perhaps Dr. Pensack can talk about this, but some of the techniques that insurance companies use that require women to fail a certain choice first, their choice, before the woman can move on to what she and her doctor prefer, and to expedite the choice and the most effective treatment for women.
Dr. Pensack, is that something you run into as a doctor at Planned Parenthood?
Yeah, as as an OBGYN, this is something that I see, almost daily in practice, and a lot of my colleagues do as well. This tension we have with the insurance companies to get the right contraceptive method covered for our patients. Dean Darr is exactly right that this is something that patients are put through hoops to jump through. And a lot of times people wind up just giving up and paying out of pocket because it is such an onerous process for both the doctor and the patient to navigate the insurance company game. So for example, contraception is it's not one size fits all. And a lot of what we spend our time with patients is really trying to be focused on what's best for the patient. How do we help them meet their goals, both for their reproductive planning, for their lifestyle, what's important to them? And it's really hard when you spend all this time with your patient having that really thoughtful conversation, and you come to the method that's best for them, that's safest for them, only to be told by the insurance company, well, you need to try X, Y, or Z first, or, well, that pill might not be covered because it's a brand name or a generic and the formulary only covers this one. And we know that as healthcare providers, that our institutions are really taxed for resources to help our patients navigate these really complicated systems. And so it's hard when you have to sit to there and say to the patient, I'm sorry, we spent all this time and relationship working out a plan for you. But, now we either need to have you cover some of the costs, or we got to go back to the insurance company again and really show them why this is so important, even though this is something that they have a right to access and a right to access without cost.
Well, and Dr. Pensack, as an OBGYN, my assumption is that you are, for the most part, prescribing birth control to prevent pregnancy. But, you know, I have friends who use the birth control pill for other reasons, too. You know, you mentioned heavy periods, but there are also migraines. I have friends who take, hormone therapy to try to mitigate their migraine problems. So there are lots of reasons women could be accessing this care, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. Birth control, you know, we call it birth control, right? Because when it was developed, it was really developed for stopping pregnancy and helping people plan their families the way they wanted and giving people that could get pregnant that power and control over their body. But we know that people use those hormonal methods, whether it's the pills, whether it's the intrauterine devices, whether it's the injectables, for many reasons. So like you mentioned, some people use them for side effects like migraines, acne, people with endometriosis or polycystic ovarian syndrome, which can be really quite debilitating conditions for many people who menstruate. And for them, these methods can be life-saving and really help people live their lives in a better way. And so, you know, yes, we want it for the contraception and we want it for the birth control to help people have that control over their lives, but we also want to be able to use these medications for their maximum effect as well. And many of those can also be prohibitive in cost, even when people aren't using them for the birth control or contraception part of it.
Again, we're talking about why some women are paying for birth control that's supposed to be free under federal law. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dean Dar, I referenced this just a little bit earlier, but now there's another lawsuit making its way through the courts that seeks to strike down the ACA's requirements for private insurers to cover certain types of preventative care, including birth control. Talk to us about the approach that case is taking to this question. It seems to be focused on, are the people making these decisions, you know, correctly appointed to the boards on which they serve?
Yeah, the ACA, as we know, was challenged from the outset, and the Supreme Court, in a very interesting decision, did uphold the constitutionality of the ACA. So this may be another approach chipping away at the ACA with a different court and on a slightly different argument. And we have seen the court look at these arguments about the Administrative Procedure Act, that is the way in which rulemaking unfolds, and sometimes they're friendly to that argument and sometimes they're not. Lucy, I think if I could pivot just a moment, I think it's interesting perhaps for our listeners to think about why we're talking about this now so robustly, 2 years after the decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health was handed down. And I think a lot of people are seeing a relationship between abortion regulation in the states and access to contraception. And if that's something that you wanted to talk about, I could just make one point.
Sure, go ahead.
We learn, and we now have discussed for 2 years, that the access to abortion has been sent back to the states, and we are seeing a checkerboard landscape across the country in terms of access. But that should not necessarily affect access to contraception for the following reason. If you read every state's abortion law, and I have, you see that abortion is tethered to an ongoing pregnancy, the establishment of a pregnancy. So in order for abortion to be activated, there would have to be a pregnancy in place. And the idea behind contraception, logically and of course medically, is the prevention of a pregnancy. So we shouldn't really see any legal link between the abortion laws in any particular state and access to contraception, because they don't really vest in the same arena medically, legally, and perhaps, you know, psychologically, socially, in other ways as well. So I think that's part of the, like, higher level landscape that's going on in this discussion.
I appreciate you bringing that up, Dean Dar. There does seem to be a link for some people, though, politically. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but in Project 2025, this conservative blueprint for what a second Trump administration could look like, it calls for removing some forms of emergency contraception from no-cost coverage. Do you have thoughts on the implications of that?
Certainly, legally speaking, again, I would argue, just based on the plain meaning of the legislation, that EC, emergency contraception, is not abortion. Again, there's not an attachment, and again, Dr. Pensek, I defer to you, but there's not an attachment of an embryo into the uterine lining. The idea is essentially to disrupt that process. So technically and legally, they shouldn't be linked. But I understand the emotional symbolism behind this approach and the reason why those who oppose abortion in general would be taking it. But again, I would argue legally that they are unlinked and should not be tethered in this argument.
Dr. Pensek, Dean Darr just, you know, a moment ago talked about how this discussion is all happening as women across the country have uneven access to abortion care. Do you think that reduced access to free birth control could lead to more unwanted pregnancies?
I think it could. I think that in the broad sense of what an unwanted pregnancy is, and you know, there's its own issues with classifying things that, and I think what's really important is that being able to control when you get pregnant, how you get pregnant, if you don't get pregnant, is really important. And we do see that in places where contraception is not easily accessed, whether that's because of that either there are just places where there are not enough physicians or health centers. We know that people who live in low socioeconomic status, people of color, really minorities, that already have a hard time engaging with the healthcare systems for a multitude of reasons, both for lack of access, but lack of resources, distrust in our medical systems. We know that in those populations, there is already a higher risk of pregnancy that's either mistimed or unwanted. And we know that those pregnancies go on to have poor outcomes. So not only risks during the pregnancy, like preterm birth, preterm labor, but we know that those children that are born from those pregnancies are also affected as well. And so this is not just this issue of a single lens access to birth control. We know that it's a ripple effect that really does affect the well-being of not only patients who use contraception, but their family, our society at large. And so I think patients, especially people, especially when they see these rollback of access to care, whether it's contraception, whether it's abortion, that there's a lot of personal feeling that what might be next, and an almost panic feeling of if this could happen to something that I didn't think could be taken away, what might be the next thing? Even if there isn't that legal argument, and I definitely defer to Dean Darr on that as the legal expert, but just from what I'm hearing from my patients, from the lay person, of a fear of what could come next.
Well, and Dr. Pensek, in terms of those outcomes, you were talking about the outcomes that babies can face, the outcomes mothers can face after pregnancy. Can all that contribute to infant mortality and maternal mortality?
Of course it can. And we're, you know, we see this in the data, and we know that in the data that places when pregnancies are planned, that a risk of infant mortality is down. We know that in places that support initiatives for comprehensive reproductive health care, for comprehensive maternal and child health care, we know that outcomes are better. We know that the rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality are lower. And we know that places that have very restrictive access that prohibit people from getting that comprehensive care, that those rates go up. This is all tied together. And I think that we will see even more of this data coming out as we get further away from the Dobbs decision and we're really able to drill down on some of those numbers. But we know that this is all tied together.
Dean Darr, I have a question for you that's got a lot of kind of hypotheticals built into it. So forgive me for that. But if
my favorite hypothetical.
There you go. If the federal requirements for birth control coverage cease to exist, either because of a federal law passed or these lawsuits that are working their way through the courts, my understanding is that would leave the question up to the states. But states Also, my understanding is that they have limited authority because a federal law prevents them from regulating employer-funded health plans. So could this lead to another kind of patchwork situation if this federal requirement is struck down for some reason?
That's a great question, and I think you have law professor in your future. actually, in 2000, well before the ACA, the EEOC issued an opinion that provides that employers who provide prescription drug coverage for their employees but not birth control violate Title VII of the Civil Rights Act as sex discrimination, essentially. So what I'm saying is there's already a bar to not providing birth control as part of a comprehensive plan for prescription coverage. So you'd have to really dial back everything in order to take away birth control based on a sex discrimination claim. So there is some floor, if you will, some coverage to prevent the kind of scenario that you've described. So we need to be aware that this can be a sex-based issue, and we do have protections under federal law that would apply to the states. Mm-hmm. In addition, I could talk about ERISA and the employee funds that you spoke about, but there's even broader protection from the Civil Rights Act.
Interesting. You kind of started to refer to this before, Dr. Pensack, but I want to really stress this. Are there particular groups of people, particular demographics who are most likely to feel the impact of a change if there is a greater change in terms of access to contraception?
Yeah, I think that the people that will feel this most are people that are already struggling to, one, pay that extra cost for contraception if it's not fully covered. I think the other, other big group for patient, the people that will struggle are people that are already uninsured and might be accessing contraception through things like the Title X programs that provide no cost birth control and family planning resources to low income people.
Yeah, we will leave it there. I appreciate it. I've been talking with Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Dean and Professor of Law Judith Darr and Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio physician Dr. Meredith Pensack. Thank you for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May.